Agenda item number 14. This would be a briefing here from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science concerning the Gwin Islands VDOT bridge rehabilitation and its impact, potential impact on a nearby hatchery.
Thank you, Commissioner Bull. This is just an update for you. It's been completed since the summer, and you guys have been working pretty hard and haven't had time for just an update. I'll be pretty brief with it and then attempt to answer any questions that you may have. So the issue is, this goes back to the spring of March 2014, Oyster Seed Holding, which is a hatchery located on Gwin's Island, had normal spawning that year from February to May. And I should say something about Oyster Seed Holding first before I go any further, because we're going to talk about some impacts to them. But that has a ripple effect that impacts much of the Virginia oyster aquaculture industry, because they're a major supplier of seed to a number of different growers. And not just aquaculture, but also the restoration efforts. But beginning the week of March 10, 2014, the operator observed unusual larval feeding and growth problems, followed by mortality in the hatchery. Just a couple points. The important here: spring, this time that it happened, is usually the most productive period with few water quality problems. And the hatcheries always have times that they experience water quality problems. Oyster Seed Holdings has a multi-year track record of success. They're a particularly good hatchery. But these problems were encountered for 10 to 12 weeks and lasted through May. Concurrent with this, sandblasting of the, and I use sand pretty generically. Sometimes they have sand, other times they had different materials as the grit. You'll see grit appear sometimes in sandblasting. The bridge paint started on March the 11th, same week that this was done, with incomplete containment of the waste products. By regulation, at least, they're supposed to be contained, and the attempts that were being done weren't complete, as noted by the inspector, VDOT, who on several times through that period intermittently had concerns regarding the sufficiency of containment. That was noted a few times from mid-March to mid-May. And that inspector's notes, again, from VDOT, indicate that additional measures were to be taken to contain the waste and the wash water. Bridge work, however, was halted on June the 2nd when it became apparent that this might have been a problem. It was halted from the top down, the Secretary of Transportation, who I think might have received a call shortly before that from the Secretary of Natural Resources, called and said, put an end to it. Oyster production in the hatchery had improved through even before that a little bit with filtration through a carbon filter, as the operator of that hatchery continued to try a lot of things. But it did not return to normal until the second week of June, a full week after this had ended. So the question was, could the metals associated with the paint and the grit or the sanding material from the Gwin's Island Bridge have contributed to the feeding and mortality problems? They're located, the bridge here, the hatchery there, are about a kilometer apart. That's a thin coating on the bridge. By some calculations, and some in VDOT, had suggested there's just not enough material. And so we really didn't know. There were potentially some alternative explanations. One would have been internal problems within a hatchery. Anybody who's operated a hatchery can tell you, and we can tell you, that's the first place to look. Harmful algae blooms, which are known to occur in the area, or some other nearby contaminants. And, of course, we're really coming into this as kind of a forensic investigation. The mortality was well underway when we were informed about it. But what we did was to begin some investigations in May, and this is just an outline. I'm not going to go through any of the details of all of them. Quantitative metals analysis on the paint. What's in this paint? And I'm not going to show you a full list of it. I'll tell you the biggest one of concern to us looked like it was zinc. And also then doing bioassays, that is oyster larvae in a hatchery, I mean, in a laboratory, in a controlled setting, in this case with ground-up paint chips and with the zinc, as you'll see. We did analyses of nearby wild mussels and oysters in the bridge sites and others to look at metals concentrations in their tissues. We ran a three-dimensional complex hydrodynamic flow model in the area with inert particles put in it to even ask the question, a kilometer away, what kind of dilution do you get? Could you possibly have gotten enough zinc there? These laboratory bioassays included zinc in what we call a positive control, make sure zinc was toxic to them, filtered river water, a negative control, paint debris. We did find in some of our sampling two species of algae that contribute to harmful algae blooms, both in the water and in the tanks inside the hatchery. But we found them at lower levels than you'd typically have in a bloom quantity. So we used these HAB, harmful algae bloom species, in the low concentrations that we found them in the hatchery tanks, also in our bioassay, to say, could they have been causing the problem? And we used the paint and the harmful algae blooms in combination. And I'm not going to bore you with lots of the results, but if you look at the upper right-hand corner, where the upper graph, the purple one is the control, filtered water with no paint in it. The middle one is paint at 50, I think that was their paint ground up at 50 microns, at 50 milligrams per liter, parts per thousand, and then zinc, which was done at 50 milligrams, parts per million, and then the zinc in 10 parts per million. You see that the zinc killed everything. The ground up paint killed a lot of them. And then the lower panel is simply growth. You see the reverse pattern in growth, is that it slowed down their growth. So whether we use pure zinc, which was in the paint, or paint residue ground up, we found effects on growth and effects on mortality. And then there's just the qualitative effects of how they look. The upper right-hand corner are oyster larvae in the controls. Their guts are dark. That's the algae that they're feeding on. The ones in the middle are in the zinc. Lots of them are clear. You can't see them. Others that are still alive, their guts aren't very full. And then the ones that are in paint are down there. Showed those pictures to the operator of oyster seed holdings, and that's the pattern he was seeing. We did a whole series of dilutions of the paint, and I'm not going to step all the way through this other than to say it's pretty clear the more paint, the more mortality and the slower growth rate. What would really be critical on this is if we really knew exactly how much paint, we don't know the pace at which paint came off the bridge. We know they were working for a 10 to 12 week period, but how much came in when? How should we feed it into the model? Did it all pulse in at once? How much of it were they doing on a ebbing tide and so it went out into the bay? What we really can't know in this is how much got dosed at the bridge at a given point of time. But I'll come back to how that's important in a minute. But when we look at the harmful algae bloom species, the top panel is the number of larvae alive and versus dead in the controls. One species at a low, one species one at intermediate, species two at a low, species two at an intermediate, and the mix of the two together, you actually see that somewhere in the intermediate paint treatments that the intermediate algae treatments, again, species that at higher concentrations we know are toxic, but at these lower concentrations, they actually had better survival. And those are the concentrations range that we found in the hatchery. So between that and the growth data that's here, our conclusion on that is that at the concentrations, the below bloom concentrations of these two harmful algae species that we found, the larvae were unlikely to be impacted. Now, our sampling took place after the larval mortalities were occurring, but still during the period. So So this is a map of the area again. We're going to see Fiddle Run. Here we go. Whoops. Why did it do that to me? It's doing something different on my screen, but we'll get there in a minute. Make it run this. There we go. So if we add, oh, that's unhappy because your technician, it's running wonderfully on my screen and it's not transferring to there. We'll give it one more try. But if it doesn't, and your audio video tech people were excellent, and David in helping me get all this set up, and then it's still not running the video. So the main point then is we find the scale is somewhat arbitrary, but the what we can do is put in X amount, and you see how much it gets diluted. And within a half tidal cycle, stuff coming in from the bridge in this three-dimensional model, which is pretty well calibrated, makes it, without being diluted tenfold, it's still in the same category band of reds up to that hatchery. And it shows that it sloshes back and forth for several days before that moves out. So I think what it established for us is that you can get from the bridge, stuff can get from the bridge to the hatchery without a lot of dilution and mixing. And it can get a couple of doses over several days. Again, what we don't really know is the pace at which we know how much stuff was washed off the bridge, but we don't know how to dose it in there in a way that's exactly what happened. So let's see if this is going to choose to. It's interesting. It's very interesting. Your whole thing, it just froze. We'll see if we can make it work. Go. Spinny wheel of death down there. So I just have two more slides. In summary, and I haven't shown you the long list of other contaminants we found, 5-day-old larvae, which is what we chose to work with because they're better in assays, are highly sensitive to dissolved zinc. Really highly sensitive. Parts per million, you're killing them all. 5-day-old larvae are also highly sensitive to paint from the bridge. We just rounded up in the with a pestle and mortar. And zinc and some other metals that were in there. There's lead, there's aluminum, or others may have only been involved in this mortality then. How much paint and how much debris escaped from the bridge and in what sequence, we don't know. How much of that settled out to the bottom? How much of it's in the sediments below that hatchery? We don't know. But we do know that they can be sensitive to that paint, and we know that it can get there. There were very little effects, and some of them positive, of the algae bloom species on survival, and some effects on growth. I do want to acknowledge at this point that VDOT funded part of this study. That didn't begin to fund at all. Then most of them responded to it, but it did take VDOT took these concerns very seriously. In particular, we worked with two individuals in the environmental department. Ed Wallingford and Cooper Wamsley. And so my final thing about this is as take-home points. The first really important take-home point, because oyster seed holdings is up and running now, and as far as I know, had a pretty good year in 2015. But this industry that we're all so pleased with how it's growing is really critically dependent upon water quality. And something as small as just a really thin layer of paint being blasted off. And the contractor was catching some of this stuff. They were sort of weakly trying to do what the regs call for. It just wasn't very good. And everything we looked at doesn't confirm that it was this, but it really points to this as the most likely cause. It seems to line up from all the different studies we did. And it really only took something that seems pretty small. And this had a big ripple effect. There were a lot of growers that didn't get seed because they were planning on getting it from that hatchery. So the growth and survival in the hatchery. The other point is that if that was the cause, and it was killing larvae for that length of time in his hatchery,
What was it doing? That's the time that larvae in the water column out there in the wild. What was it doing to all the water? I mean, all the larvae in the water going in and out of there. The state's got a fair amount of restoration effort ongoing in that area. And state and federal monies went into a good bit of restoration in that area in this past year. And we have no idea because you really can't sample that with the wild larvae. So I think there's really good cause to concern and to realize that these hatcheries in a lot of ways can provide a really good barometer for us of what might be happening in the field. And I want to sort of repeat that even though our findings didn't conclusively prove that this waste from the bridge was responsible for the observed mortality, I do think it's a good point to make that VDOT took it really seriously. There was a stop work order that came from above. They provided some of the support that did this, and they're in the process of developing new protocols and sort of reaffirming the existing ones they had for bridge cleaning. So I think that's a plus. So that's all I have, but I'm happy to answer any questions about it. Obviously, it's something we took seriously at BIMS. We jumped on that with a whole lot of people and tried to provide answers when we didn't know what they would be on the way.
Mrs. Cullen.
Question.
Yes.
You tested the paint chips from the bridge, and if they weren't containing all the paint, then they probably weren't containing the sandblast material used either. Did you experiment or test with the blast material?
They used a couple of different blast materials. They used something called, Black Beauty at first, and then there was just a sand. We got hold of some of the Black Beauty and some of the sand. You know, the thing I think the telltale thing, we knew going into this, oyster larvae are sensitive to metal ions. I mean, that's why you use copper-based paints on boats, and that's why tributyl tin was a particularly killer. And so we looked for TBT, we looked for oxygen. Zinc was the likely one. And so I think, and was really in high, it was the major constituent of that paint and metals. So the Black Beauty didn't seem to do anything in our bioassays. We just got some of it. Now when they sandblasted, you've got all those pieces mixed together. And we didn't do our assays with all those pieces mixed together because we're trying to tease out the individual parts. If that answers your question.
Thank you.
Ms. Erskine.
Mark, so I see that there were some results on the bioassays where you kind of injected, I guess, lack of a better word, the zinc at different concentrations into a larval bioassay and that killed larvae. Yeah. But did you take water from the hatchery that was actually being used and
yes.
determine the level of zinc in that
yes.
water?
Yes. And the zinc was not that high in the water by the time we did it. Remember, we got called in late. You know, Mike's a very good hatchery operator. He spent all due diligence making sure it wasn't on the inside. I think what you find in something like that, my guess is, that zinc is pretty quickly taken up into the phytoplankton, ends up fed upon in the guts. It might even have been, we even tested what was in the algae culture. And there was some in the algae culture. And now that's probably the method by which it was doing that and acting. And then the mortalities weren't terribly acute. They were larvae not feeding for several days and then crashing. Yeah, there's a lot more. I think there's a lot more. This is not a full-blown study that we set out to examine zinc toxicity or that paint as much as really a forensic investigation. You know, really quickly, got into the end of the event, try to identify what are all the possible sources of problems possible, and then try to quickly see which ones we can eliminate or which ones are still hanging around. Obviously, because of the stop work order, I mean, people were focused on the bridge. We thought it might be, but we were really intent that it not be just a witch hunt for that, that we check other things. We look to see. There was some suggestion that there's a small boat yard that's closer to the hatchery than the bridge is. And when that was brought up, just questioning by VDOT, could that have been it? she led the study, but she had back surgery Friday. And she could probably give you the sequence of how this happened. What we inquired at that marina, had there been any boats cleaned at that time, both of the folks at the boat yard and HES my condo. So we were really intent on rather than delving into every last mechanism that the zinc and the paint might have caused, just looking broadly enough to see if were we missing something. You know, we don't want to point a finger where it shouldn't be pointed, but the best evidence we can come up suggests that it was waste material from that bridge. You know, how much is the zinc, how much is other things in the paint, how much is the, any additive effect of having blasted the Black Beauty or the grit in there. Anything is most of that. We really don't expect that most of that even made it to the hatch because it's heavy. You know,
I had a follow-up question.
Mr. Erskine.
With everything that took place in the response, I guess, from VDOT as well as VIMS jumping into this, the connection may be there or it's suspected to be there, but the actual response, if other hatcheries, ran into issues, this could happen anywhere at any time, really. So has VIMS developed a response protocol for hatcheries?
That's a good question. You work closer with us, and you've done this, and so you know, if you're doing anything in your shellfish, and you thought before, I think I've got a disease problem. You pick up the phone and you call our disease pathologist, right? If you think, no, I think I got a harmful algae problem, you pick up the phone and you call Kim Reese. And so for a couple of weeks, Mike Congo had done just that. And individuals went out to investigate quickly their individual thing. And once I saw how that was happening, we now absolutely, on any inquiry from the industry about a problem, because you might think it's disease, and then your second choice might be harmful algae, but it might be metals. We have everybody gets copied on the email internal events on a response to that, so that any of the possible problems it could be, everybody knows that they're working on. We discussed having a single point of entry for industry in the VIMS with problems, but how do we convey that? And then what do we do if somebody doesn't follow and you call your favorite person to ask? So I think we've got a very effective method now, even more effective than we have a much more coordinated everybody in the loop response. Because this, it was a learning experience for us too, is these can be complex issues. Think about it. We had physics department people, hydrodynamic modelers. We had metals chemists involved. We had two people who do bioassays involved. We had two people who do harmful algae bloom toxins involved. Ryan Carnegie looked at the larvae for disease. I didn't even point this out. He looked at those for disease. So it should be upon the industry to identify all those pieces. You come in through any door at VIMS, anybody in the industry, and say, we're having this problem, and everybody's in the loop, by the way.
Thank you.
I find out how to David can get you back to you.
Mark, let me say a couple things. I'm very grateful to the work that VIMS did on this and the resources you all brought to bear on this conundrum, this canary in a coal mine. I think it was a very valuable lesson we all learned. It's sad that it was such an expensive lesson for the hatchery, but I think there's lessons learned here that are going to play out to the benefit of everyone in the industry now that VDOT has a better awareness of where things, what their operations may do to impact water quality that can have ripple effects. I also want to publicly express my gratitude for Secretary of Natural Resources Molly Ward and Secretary of Transportation Aubrey Lane, who, when this was brought to their attention, they acted with alacrity. And they reached the consensus quickly, this needs to be stopped for fuller investigation. There was no bureaucratic turf war. There was just a uniformed response to stop and to get things examined here so we don't have to go through this again. And thank you for all the work you and your team did to get us to this point. Unless there's anything else on that subject matter here, let's move on to fisheries matter here.
Commissioner.
Mr. Tankard.
You know, I think one thing that I don't know if Mr. Ballard's seen some of the same things with his hatchery in Willis Wharf, but I think we can say that other hatcheries may have seen similar incidences, and there's oftentimes springtime incidences, creosote poles moved around. Do we need to be protecting some of these hatcheries, because spring is their time of year. Spring's when they get the job done. I don't know if we as a commission need to try to ensure their success by protecting them. I sometimes hear about things that just don't sound just right, where people aren't being careful of their surroundings.
I think that's a really good point that you made. It's clear how much you value this industry. And there's a role for us to play in that, too, in terms of, you know, we're all used to doing time-of-year restrictions for wild fisheries, in terms of in-water projects. I think we need to pay really close attention. And I don't want to just single them out. We may well find there are other particularly sensitive areas, too. But I think because there's relatively few hatcheries, given the size of our aquaculture industry, we need to be really, really mindful of the areas around them and their water quality. Be mindful. It's also if it's killing larvae in the hatchery, it's killing larvae in the wild too. So it should be teaching us something there. But yeah, I think you bring up a very good point. VDOT for their ask, where are the locations of all the hatcheries now? But I think we will do our best now also in commenting on other habitat-related proposals. It's not a place you don't want to see dredging around a hatchery. And you want that off-season. You want that in the wintertime. So.
Mr. Ballard.
Just to echo Mr. Tankard's comments, I think it would be good for everyone to be aware that, particularly for the hard clam industry, which in Virginia is often overlooked compared to the oyster industry, but is the largest hard clam industry on the East Coast, probably 95% of the clams produced in Virginia are produced in one waterway in the town of Willis Wharf, Virginia. And so that's probably 60-70% of the East Coast supply is produced in one area where there are 3-4 hatcheries currently operating. And some of these environments would be very easy to protect because they're so concentrated. And I think that was an excellent suggestion.
It's easy for you to protect it in the areas that you have jurisdiction. But of course, most of what's happening in the coastal waters is happening on the land. It's running off into those waters, too, and you don't have jurisdiction. But it's still helpful to be really mindful of it.
Thank you very much. It's been a very productive discussion.